Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 737, Takiya Sunrise, Part 2, Turkish Taffy, More on the Rolling Coups in the Middle East. This program has been recorded on March 20th of the year 2011. Very quickly again, Takiya is a principle of Islamic struggle and warfare in which devout Muslims are required as a matter of religious doctrine to lie to enemies or potential enemies about matters of significance. And there are significant indications that the Muslim Brotherhood, enabled in great measure by the American media component of the intelligence community and State Department, is in fact engaging in takiya, basically the strategic lying about matters of importance vis-a-vis the history and operations of the Muslim Brotherhood. And also, the reference to Turkish taffy, of course, it's a type of candy. And what we're being told as part of the takiya is that the Muslim Brotherhood aspires to repeat the example of the Turkish AK party, and that they're just nice moderates and that we don't have to worry about anything. I believe that, like Turkish taffy, this is a sweetened confection, that something is being made to appear artificially sweet, and it will not prove to be very nutritious, and it's going to prove to be pretty tough on our teeth as we try to assimilate it as well. But that is the relationship to the title. Now, again, why would the Muslim Brotherhood, with its corporatist free market ideology, again, hearkening to Ibn Khaldun, the Milton Friedman of the Islamic world, why would we necessarily see them as the goal of an operation undertaken during the Bush administration and continued into the Obama administration and deliberately exposed courtesy of WikiLeaks? That's one of the reasons why in 735 I alluded to this as the Bay of Pigs meeting the October surprise, because it was an operation begun under Bush, continued under Obama, and deliberately leaked and therefore, I believe, botched, even if there were any hope of it really succeeding to begin with. And I'm not sure that's the case. We're going to review an article that has appeared in many broadcasts, several excerpts of articles that have appeared in many broadcasts. This from For the Record program number 415, an article called "In Difficult Times, Muslims Count on Unlikely Advocate." It's by Tom Hamburger and Glenn R. Simpson from The Wall Street Journal. And the exact date is, it will be in the description for the show. The article reads, "That brief conversation between Norquist and Karl Rove in Austin, Texas, helped start a new chapter in Mr. Norquist's career and in the political lives of Muslims in this country. The following year, Grover Norquist started the nonprofit Islamic Free Market Institute. In collaboration with Karl Rove, now Mr. Bush's chief political advisor, Norquist and other institute leaders courted Muslim voters for the Bush 2000 presidential campaign. Mr. Norquist even credits gains among Muslims with putting Mr. Bush in a position to win the critical Florida contest. To run the nonprofit's day-to-day operations, Mr. Norquist turned to Khaled Safouri, a Palestinian-American raised in Kuwait who had been an official of the American Muslim Council, a political group in Washington. The Institute's founding chairman was a Palestinian-American, Talat Otman, who had served with Mr. Bush on the board of Harkin Energy Corporation and later visited the president in the White House, according to records obtained by the National Security News Service." And another article, after the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids uncovered a number of individuals and institutions in the Washington Beltway area as being complicit with the funding of Al-Qaeda, allegedly complicit with the funding of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the aforementioned Talat Otman interceded with the then Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. And this article is from "O'Neill Met Muslim Activists Tied to Charities." Again, Glenn R. Simpson with Roger Thurlow, Wall Street Journal, April 18th, 2002. And it says basically, the article reads in part, "Among the Muslim leaders attending the meeting with O'Neill was Talat Otman, a longtime associate and supporter of President Bush's family, who gave a benediction at the Republican convention in Philadelphia in August of 2000. Otman also serves with Barzinji on the board of Amana Mutual Funds Trust, an investment firm founded by M. Yaqub Mirza, the Northern Virginia businessman who set up most of the entities targeted by the Treasury and whose tax records were sought in the raid." And again, this is the institution set up by Karl Rove and Grover Norquist. One of the strange aspects of the Grover Norquist Islamic Free Market Institute, and it's a direct element of intersection between the Republican Party and the Muslim Brotherhood, is that the only criticism of this comes from elements of what really would have to be termed the far right. There's a book called Sharia, The Threat to America, an exercise in competitive analysis. This is put out by Report of Team B. This is from the Center for Security Policy. This Team B would appear to be a Team B that was put together to assess the threat of Islamic terrorism. And it is an amalgam of far-right luminaries or from the right wing of the Republican Party and appears to be something along the lines of a Team B that was put together by George H.W. Bush in order to create a much more sinister picture of the Soviet Union that had been provided by the intelligence services. My feeling is that there's a significant element of truth in a fair amount of the analysis presented by the Team B here, but I also think that there's a lot of ideologized propaganda, and the net effect is to be setting up the Obama administration and related elements to take the blame for something truly horrendous. But Frank Gaffney, one of the contributors to the report, a former Pentagon analyst, is one of the few people to talk about Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and their direct links not only to the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda on the one hand, but to the Republican Party on the other. So from Sharia, The Threat to America, again, an extreme right-wing document, or from the right wing of the Republican Party and related elements, we read the following about Grover Norquist. Again, the so-called progressive sector just doesn't touch this. Perhaps it's because Sami El-Aryan, the investigation into whom yielded this investigation that culminated in the March 20th, 2002 raids, Sami El-Aryan is a darling of the progressive sector. However, Frank Gaffney has properly scored Grover Norquist, and his analysis of Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, although he doesn't mention Rove by name, and their relationship to Muslim Brotherhood terrorism on the one hand, and to the Bush administration and the GOP on the other, that analysis is presented as follows. In 1998, Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi provided at least $20,000 in checks, enabling Republican activist Grover Norquist to establish what would become a Muslim Brotherhood front organization targeted at penetrating GOP circles and the presidential campaign of then-Governor George W. Bush. The new entity was called the Islamic Free Market Institute, better known as the Islamic Institute, or II. Al-Amoudi also detailed his longtime deputy, Khaled Safouri, to serve as II's first executive director, with Grover Norquist as the chairman of the board. As a result of these connections, Al-Amoudi was among a group of Muslim Brotherhood operatives who were invited on May 1, 2000 to meet with George W. Bush in the Texas governor's mansion. Safouri was designated the Bush campaign's Muslim outreach coordinator, and Norquist assisted another prominent Ikhwan operative, Sami El-Aryan, to obtain a commitment from candidate Bush that if elected, he would prohibit the use of classified intelligence evidence in deportation proceedings against foreigners suspected of terrorist ties. This was a priority for El-Aryan since his brother-in-law was being held at the time by federal immigration authorities on the basis of such evidence. After the election, a member of the Islamic Institute's board of directors with myriad and long-standing connections to other Muslim Brotherhood organizations, Suhail Khan, was appointed to be the gatekeeper for the Muslim community in the White House Office of Public Liaison. Such relationships and placements afforded the Ikhwan unprecedented opportunities for influence operations against the U.S. government, especially after 9/11. Unfortunately for Al-Amoudi, his own ability directly to exploit such opportunities had by that time been irreparably damaged by his appearance at an anti-Israel rally outside the White House in October of 2000. On that occasion, he carelessly gave the game away when he declared on video, quote, "I have been labeled as being a supporter of Hamas. Any supporters of Hamas here?" Roars of approval from the crowd. "We are all supporters of Hamas." More roars. "I wish they added that I am also a supporter of Hezbollah." More cheers. Then, in 2003, Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi was arrested at Heathrow Airport on his way back from Libya with $340,000 in cash given to him by Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi for the purposes of pursuing jihad. The money was to be used to underwrite a plot involving two UK-based Al-Qaeda operatives to kill Crown Prince, now King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. Al-Amoudi was extradited to the United States, where in the Eastern District of Virginia, he pled guilty to and was convicted of terrorism-related charges. Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi was proven to be a senior Al-Qaeda financier who moved at least $1 million to the terrorist organization. Al-Amoudi had also been caught on recorded conversations supporting acts of terrorism, terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, and clearly stated his objective of making America a Muslim nation. Al-Amoudi is now serving a 23-year sentence in federal prison. Before his fall, Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi was one of the leaders of the global Islamic movement and one of its most successful influence operatives. His arrest and conviction should have sent shockwaves through the U.S. intelligence community, particularly its counterintelligence units, since Al-Amoudi's blown cover provided a reality check on the extent of Sharia stealth jihad in this country and how badly we have been penetrated. So again, working with Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and Talat Atman, a director of Harkin Energy, one of Bush's failed energy ventures, a proven Al-Qaeda financier, and again, an individual who was setting up Muslim Brotherhood penetration of the Republican Party and the Bush administration. It's not something that took a whole lot of penetrating, as we can see. Now, again, in our last broadcast, we took a look at an op-ed column in the New York Times that was written by Tariq Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in that, basically, there was a fundamental misrepresentation of the nature and history of the Muslim Brotherhood. We're going to review this very briefly. This is from the New York Times of February 8th of 2011. It's called Wither the Muslim Brotherhood by Tariq Ramadan. The Huffington Post, among other publications, carried the same column. And skipping down, we read as follows. The Muslim Brothers began in the 1930s as a legalist, anti-colonialist, and non-violent movement that claimed legitimacy for armed resistance in Palestine against Zionist expansionism during the period before World War II. The writings from between 1930 and 1945 of Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Brotherhood, show that he opposed colonialism and strongly criticized the fascist governments in Germany and Italy. He rejected the use of violence in Egypt, even though he considered it legitimate in Palestine in resistance to the Zionist Stern and Irgun terror gangs. We're going to talk more about Tariq Ramadan's representation of the Turkish example as something that would be a positive role model for the Muslim Brotherhood. But the very next day, February 9th of 2011, the New York Times, which is the CIA's number one propaganda asset, and in many ways, the gray lady could be viewed as the voice of the American establishment. The New York Times featured yet another op-ed piece, this by Issam El-Aryan, one of the most important members of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. This is called What the Muslim Brothers Want, and it was from the very next day, February 9th of 2011. And what Issam El-Aryan writes here is also pure BS. In more than 8 decades of activism, the Muslim Brotherhood has consistently promoted an agenda of gradual reform. Our principles, clearly stated since the inception of the movement in 1928, affirm an unequivocal position against violence. The New York Times has refused to permit to print letters that were critical of these two back-to-back op-ed columns, and which basically permitted the authors to lie in their teeth. The Muslim Brotherhood is not a nonviolent organization, and as we indicated in For the Record 736, the Muslim Brotherhood was allied with the Axis as a combatant. They were military and political allies of the Axis, and they were anything but nonviolent. We're going to get into the realities of the Turkish AK party in just a couple of minutes, but taking a look at the history of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I've spoken at great length and just alluded to its fascist nature and history. We've talked about the Muslim Brotherhood as an Islamic fascist organization in innumerable programs in the past. One of the features of the SpitfireList.com website I want to encourage people to use, and that is the books section. One of the many books that is available for download for free and really compact, easy to use PDF files is the book Cairo to Damascus from John Roy Carlson. John Roy Carlson was a famous, well, to the extent that any anti-fascist writer was famous, a pretty well-known anti-fascist writer in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods. Probably his best-known book is Undercover, written in 1943. And in 1951, he published Cairo to Damascus, in which he recounted his experiences as a first-hand witness to and journalistic infiltrator of the Nazi and Muslim Brotherhood recrudescence in the Middle East after World War II. And there's a whole chapter about the Muslim Brotherhood in Cairo to Damascus. Now, bear in mind again that in 2 days back-to-back, February 8th and February 9th, Tariq Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Brotherhood, and Assam al-Arian, a key member of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, lied in their teeth about the history and methodology of the Muslim Brotherhood, talking about it as having taken an unequivocal position against violence. Let's contrast that with the realities of the Muslim Brotherhood as recorded by John Roy Carlson. Now, the book Cairo to Damascus was published in 1951. Hassan al-Banna was assassinated in 1948, so these interviews were conducted in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And on pages 90 and 91 of Cairo to Damascus, we read the following. He, Hassan al-Banna, the Murshid or Supreme Guide, also had a special assassin squad entrusted with the duty of liquidating political opponents. Al-Banna resented a verdict that Judge Ahmad el-Kazindar Bey meted out against a Muslim brother and ordered him liquidated. One of the Murshid's henchmen took care of the assignment, aided by an assistant who pumped 6 bullets into the judge. Under public pressure, Cairo's police chief staged a few raids and made a few arrests. Al-Banna was annoyed at this. He ordered his terror squad to teach the police chief a lesson, unquote. The latter was promptly killed by a hand grenade while on a tour of inspection of Fuad University. When the president of Fuad complained about the killing, he was denounced as a, quote, European, unquote, publicly insulted and narrowly missed being shot by an assassin. Al-Banna played for high stakes. Not content with liquidating a judge and a police chief, he ordered Abdel Magid Ahmed Hassan, a 23-year-old student and a member of his terror squad, to carry out his duty to Allah. A religious sheikh told Hassan that the Quran sanctioned the murder of the enemies of Islam and of Arabism, whereupon Hassan dutifully swore to kill any traitor the Murshid named. Hassan retired and spent his days in meditation, prayer, and preparation. On the 10th day after his oath, he donned a policeman's uniform and went to the Ministry of Interior, where he waited for the Egyptian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Fahmy el-Nakrashi Pasha, to emerge. As soon as Nakrashi Pasha appeared, followed by his bodyguard, Abdel whipped out a pistol and shot the minister dead. His duty to the Murshid al-Banna and to Allah fulfilled, his place in heaven assured. Again, so much for the outright bald-faced lies that the New York Times has been floating on its op-ed page and the criticism of which they have refused to print. Now, I see those two back-to-back op-ed columns as very significant and indications that, again, the New York Times being the CIA's number one propaganda asset, and I see that as confirmation that, in fact, the piggyback coup, as I call it, in which the Bay of Pigs is meeting the October surprise, is, in fact, an intelligence op. And I think that one faction of the U.S., pro-democracy or pro-democratic party and Obama faction of the intelligence community and State Department is being set up to take an enormous fall, one that is going to prove, I think, consummately destructive to the future of the Democratic Party in the United States, consummately destructive to the U.S., period. And, the damage that I think is going to be done to the future of the human race could not be exaggerated. But one of the things that I want to stress about these flat-out lies that are being floated by the New York Times. This is not the first time we've seen things like this. I want to encourage members of the listening audience to use the SpitfireList.com website. In AFA program number one, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, part one, one of the things that is read into the record are a series of columns that are guest op-ed columns that were carried in the Hearst Press by people like Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy, Hermann Göring, the Reichsmarshal and head of the German Air Force under Hitler, people like Rudolf Hess and others. They wrote guest columns for the Hearst Press in the United States, assuring the readers of the Hearst Press that, in fact, the fascist powers of Europe had nothing but peaceful intentions. Of course, those columns were bald-faced lies, and you can actually access some of that material in AFA number one. I see the columns in the New York Times by, first of all, Tariq Ramadan and then Assam El Aryan in a very, very similar fashion. Basically, it is official lying. It is Takiya, and it also is the promulgation of a corporatist viewpoint, a corporatist future for the Middle East, and a religious fascist future for the Middle East, which I think is seen as preferable by the powers that be in this country to other, other options, shall we say. Again, there's a lot more to this than I'm going to be able to cover in this section. We're going to continue with analysis of this event. There are an awful lot of other things going on. So at times we will be taking time off to analyze other events. But let's take a look at the statement by Tariq Ramadan about what we can expect from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Again, this is from the same column in which he talked about the Muslim Brotherhood's commitment to peaceful action and its rejection of violence. You heard its commitment to peaceful action and rejection of violence described rather clearly by John Roy Carlson, who, by the way, interviewed Hassan al-Banna himself. In this very same column, Wither the Muslim Brotherhood, Tariq Ramadan writes, "Today's Muslim Brotherhood draws these diverse visions together. But the leadership of the movement, those who belong to the founding generation, are now very old, no longer fully representing the aspirations of the younger members who are more open to the world, anxious to bring about internal reform and fascinated by the Turkish example. Behind the unified hierarchical facade, contradictory influences are at work. No one can tell which way the movement will go." No indeed. However, the Turkish AK party is being seen as a very positive potential role model for the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. And indeed, we're being told that the Muslim Brotherhood is similar to the AK party and we shouldn't be afraid of it. What we're going to do is to take a look at the actual history of the evolution of the AK party and how it grew out of the Refah party and indeed the Turkish Islamist party, the AK party, is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood and it is an outgrowth of political activism by some of the, some truly vile creatures and elements. And we're going to read a little bit of the history of the AK party. Now, this is again why I'm using part of the title as Turkish Taffy, because I think that what we're seeing here is a deliberate sweetening, a confection which is in its fundamentals artificial in terms of experience, of the history of the AK party, beginning as the Refah party. It grew out of associations with Ahmed Huber of the Bank al-Taqwa. Ahmed Huber had a lot to do with helping the operations of Mr. Erbakan, and in turn, Mr. Erbakan of the Refah Party, the inspiration and mentor to Mr. Erdogan and the AK Party, Nekmetin Erbakan also had much to do with advancing the position of Ahmed Huber. The point being that what you're about to hear is not moderation. Deutsche Welle had the following article. Turkey offers support for controversial Islamic group. It reads in part, "Milligorus, Germany's largest Islamic association, recently gained the official support of the Turkish government despite being watched by German intelligence services due to alleged extremist leanings. On April 19th, Turkey's religious conservative government ordered its embassies to offer the Islamische Gemeinschaft Milligorus, or IGMG, their support. The group, formed in 1985 in Cologne to support Turkish nationalism and oppose the separation of state and religion, has long been criticized by German officials as being anti-Semitic and against liberal Western values. Turkish Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül on Saturday refused to discuss his specific directions to diplomats regarding Mille Gerus, saying only that the government, quote, has for some time tried to strengthen the ties between our country and our citizens overseas, unquote. The decision comes only 2 weeks after an agreement between Germany and Turkey on combating organized crime incensed many members of Turkey's ruling AK party because it included Mille Gerus with groups like the Kurdish terrorist outfit PKK. Since many AK members have ties to Islamic religious groups, Gül was compelled to say he did not consider Mille Gerus a terror organization. Some observers say the attempt to reform its public image could be at least partly linked to the rise of Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan and his AK party. Coming to power in a landslide victory last year, Erdogan styles his party as a modern conservative group based on Islamic values. He has distanced himself from his former mentor, Nekmetin Erbakan, who founded the Islamic-influenced Welfare Party. Erbakan's nephew, Mehmet Sabri Erbakan, was IGMG chairman until he left office after allegedly having an extramarital affair. Now we're getting down to the roots of the AK party. Again, this nice moderate organization that we're supposed to feel so good about if the Muslim Brotherhood takes the same pattern, takes the same path. Fleshing out discussion of Nekmetin Erbakan, his Refah Party, and the Muslim Brotherhood, basically more about this, a second photograph in which, by the way, they're talking about the decor here of Ahmed Huber's residence. After talking about pictures of Huber and about pictures, talking about pictures in Huber's apartment of Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, quote, a second photo, this, by the way, from the book Dollars for Terror by the Richard LaBeviere. A second photograph in which Hitler is talking with Heinrich Himmler stands next to those of Nekmetin Erbakan and Jean-Marie Le Pen, leader of the Fascist National Front. Erbakan, head of the Turkish Islamist party Refah, turned to Ahmed Huber for an introduction to the chief of the French party of the far right. Parenthetically, that's Jean-Marie Le Pen. Exiting from the meeting, which took place in September of 1995, Huber's two friends supposedly stated that they, quote, share the same view of the world, unquote, and expressed, quote, their common desire to work together to remove the last racist obstacle that still prevents the union of the Islamist movement with the national right of Europe. Again, Ahmed Huber working with Mr. Erbakan and Jean-Marie Le Pen of the Front National to unite Islamic fascism with national fascism or right-wing extremism in Europe. And again, more about Ahmed Huber. Above his desk is displayed a poster of the Imam Khomeini. The meeting changed my life, Huber says, with stars in his eyes. For years after the Federal Palace in Bern, Ahmed Huber published a European press review for the Iranian leaders under Khomeini and then for the Turkish Refah under Erbakan. Since the former lacked financial means, Huber chose to put his efforts to the service of the latter. An outpost of the Turkish Muslim Brothers, the Refah Party thus became Huber's principal employer, and it was through the intermediary of the Turkish Islamist Party that this former parliamentary correspondent became a shareholder in the Bank Al-Taqwa. And also, although we don't have time for this in this broadcast, I would note that the Turkish AK Party is very close to the European Monetary Union. However, we'll have to talk about that in the description and other broadcasts because this concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 737, Takiya Sunrise Part 2, Turkish Taffy. More about the rolling coups in the Middle East. This program is being recorded on March 20th of 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.